now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauck.
All right, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It is Wednesday, August the 12th at 9 p.m., a little past 9 p.m., but that's okay. Good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world currently. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, helping you find your courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. In fact, let's take it a little bit deeper, helping you reclaim that which you have always been and are. Very happy to be with you here tonight and every other Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time or 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and other times in between. Well, and if you've been following me for some time, you know that each and every one of these broadcasts are dedicated to integrating spirituality and our mental health through looking at various subjects and themes and so forth, but they all relate to bringing us back to the context of our relationships with ourselves, others, and God or the divine. I'm Dr. James Hauck, and if you would like more information about me, or if you just want to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I invite you to visit those websites. The first one is www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. All one word there. And the second website is www.reclaiming-authenticity.com. Okay, and if you want to call in and be part of the show, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And as you know, I'll be taking your calls after the break, about halfway through. And just in case you can't spend the entire hour with me this evening, no worries. This broadcast will be posted on the BBS Radio website, so you can go back and listen again. Or you can go back into the archives on my page and check out previous shows that you might have missed. And just a little FYI, these podcasts are also available for download on iTunes, Audible, Spotify, and Amazon Music. Well, you know, whenever I started this series, oh gosh, six-ish years ago or so, I really wanted to emphasize the integration of spirituality and our mental health. It's just something very near and dear to my heart. Because one thing is for certain, I have not only seen through these broadcasts, but also through my clinical practice, that there is a growing awareness and a hunger for people to not only integrate their mental health with their spirituality, but also to apply their spiritual growth within the context of their relationships, especially healing from intergenerational traumatic experiences. And the benefit of healing from traumatic experiences is that we often dispel mental and emotional distortions, let's just say, of who we think we are, and come just a little bit closer to discovering the fullness of who we truly are as souls. Now, if you're a fan of Edgar Cayce, he was considered to be the father of holistic medicine back in his day. And I think he was also the most documented psychic of the 20th century. Well, anyway, he once wrote that what is truly valuable in thought or truly valuable in activity and in experience is this sense of appreciation or this inner realization and understanding of oneself, namely the self in relation to others and the self in relation to God. And meditation is a means to this end. This is something where we really quiet ourselves and we listen. We get rid of all the distractions and whatever comes up during our meditations, I should say, we don't judge. We don't judge. It's just there. It's there, but it's there for a reason. So what can we learn from it? And as we come to grips with, as we go deeper and deeper and come to grips with all kinds of things about ourselves and knowing ourselves in a little bit more detail, we come to realize what gets in the way of just wanting to have that deeper relationship to God. And he's not the only one that thought this way, because there's a Dr. Harold Koenig, whom I met, oh gosh, it's probably going on 15 or 18, maybe 20 years ago. He's the director of the Center for Spirituality, Theology, and Health down there in, I believe, North Carolina. And he also notes that a person's religious and spiritual beliefs and practices, well, these are important resources for coping with illness. That was kind of his niche. That's where he really spent a lot of time and focus on his, not only his practice, but also his research. And furthermore, he says that there's been a lot of research in this particular area that really demonstrates a connection between our beliefs and our sense of well-being, you know, such as positive beliefs and the effect that they have on our well-being. And, you know, a person's religious and spiritual beliefs, you know, also provide them comfort during changing times or losses, and definitely inner strength gained from one's religion and spirituality. And it also assists in deeper meditation, contemplative prayer. And that's just to name a few. There's just a whole host of positive reasons. Now, his research highlighted the belief that improving your spiritual health may not cure an illness, you know, because many people pray for healing. Okay. But he says overall, it may help with your well-being, as well as, you know, you might feel a higher sense of purpose or peace or hope or meaning. And that you may not be able to change the outward external circumstances, but you come to peace with that. You find a higher purpose. You discover a deeper level of hope and meaning throughout. And he also says you may experience having more confidence or improved self-esteem and self-control. So there are many positive outcomes related to integrating our mental and spiritual health. And this is where I come in, because I have a keen interest in helping people live authentic lives by helping them find the courage to reclaim what has always been in them and remembering who they have always been and are as a soul. Because you've heard me say many times on this show, I have a very solid belief that all of us come into the world already equipped and graced with everything we need for in this life, in terms of our gifts, or our skills, our talents, our strengths, character traits, so on and so forth, the very best of who we are. And how we live out our, let's just say, our giftedness isn't in through various relationships. And this is a very, you know, a very important aspect when considering who we are, because although we may have similar gifts and skills and talents and strengths and character traits, okay, no two people express these identically. You know, in other words, each of us have this-ness about us that cannot be duplicated. Yeah, people are going to try to imitate how we do things, but no one can duplicate us, because within us lies what the 20th century scholar John Duns Scotus referred to as hachaetos. It's a thisness, it's a uniqueness that we all have that's different from one another. And I often explain this to kids, because this can be a very abstract thought. And I just said, look, kids, we all have a thumbprint. There's something we all have in common, okay? But no two thumbprints are alike. So therefore, your thisness or your uniqueness is all on you. Nobody else has this. Okay? And therein lies this importance of the realization of who we are. So I guess in all honesty, don't get trapped in this illusion that you have to go in search of something that you already are or that you already have. Because certainly godly or divine love, or the language of the soul, let's just say, it isn't entangled in the human emotions of the mind. You know, divine love is eternal. It's not conditional, as I'll say more about that later on. And it also helps others purify their minds by recognizing only that which is divine in all. So discover who you are and be that soulful presence in the world. And in all honesty, folks, this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about. It can be summed up in one word, namaste, which roughly translated means the fact that I see myself as a soul of light. This allows me to greet your lighted soul of who you are, even if you don't see it in yourself. Well, welcome to August 12th. And we just come through the dog days of summer, which I think dog days of summer run from July 3rd through August 11th. Okay. And, you know, the dog days of summer, this has nothing to do with the droopiness and laziness of dogs during summer months. You know, in other words, like the weather is so hot and sultry that it's just not fit for a dog. Well, trust me on this one. I have two dogs that can be lazy all year long, regardless of the temperature. It doesn't matter. They wake up tired. Okay. But anyway, this, you know, in this period of intense heat, it also coincides with the appearance of the dog star, which is actually part of the constellation Canis Major. Okay. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but it's there. Now, in ancient Greece, you know, the Greeks believed in its brilliance, you know, that this star, the dog star, was the brightest star in the Canis Major constellation. And the ancient Romans actually believed that the dog star gave off heat because, again, it was the brightest star in the constellation, but it actually gave off heat that intensified the summer sun. And even its name that they gave it, you know, Sirius, even means scorching. And for the Egyptians, this is kind of interesting here. For the Egyptians, Sirius signaled the annual flooding of the Nile, which was crucial for their agriculture and survival. It just left this beautiful silt in which really nurtured the land and the vegetation. And they depended on the Nile flooding year after year. Now, the lore surrounding Sirius has endured for thousands of years. Okay. And, you know, it's just quite interesting, the things you learn just by looking up at the stars. Well, we're not going to really talk about stars tonight, but what we are going to talk about is this oneness, the oneness that we have that goes beyond blood and water. Now, I'm sure all of us have heard at one time or another the phrase, blood is thicker than water, which means your family allegiance, you know, your kin, your blood, you know, tu sangre in Spanish, should take precedence over all other relationships, whether they be friendships or work colleagues or any other connections that we have. Now, this phrase is often heard when it comes down to choosing sides, you know, especially when it comes to deciding where exactly do your loyalties lie above all else. Are you with us? Because after all, blood is thicker than water. Or does your allegiance lie elsewhere? Well, I did a little checking on this phrase, blood is thicker than water, and I discovered something really fascinating. It is more than likely originating from this medieval battlefield or an alliance ritual in which the warriors who were getting ready to fight each other would often mix a drop of each other's blood into this communal bowl of water, symbolizing that this new bond was thicker than the blood ties that they may be forced to break. Okay, now in that context, it wasn't really a celebration of family loyalty, but it was actually a legal contract. In other words, so if you made such an oath, your new pledge would override family duties. However, you know, since then, this phrase, blood is thicker than water, has been a long-standing proverb that really traditionally means familial bonds are stronger than other relationships. You know, over time, that statement really came to refer to your overall commitment to your family above everything and everyone else. But what about your blood connection to your ancestors? You know, your lineage. Aren't they blood relatives too? I mean, after all, their DNA flows through your blood and into future generations. Everybody that's come before us, everybody that's going to come after us. So, just how far back do you have to trace that family obligation? Do you trace it as far back as that you can make out the names in the family Bible? Or does it go back as far as ancestry.com can record? Or what about even further? Well, let me ask you another question here, just to muddy the waters, so to speak. What do you think happens if anybody in the family dares to cross that bloodline or to break those unwritten family rules that the blood represents? For example, what happens when a blood relative, wants to marry someone outside the family's religion? Or they fall in love with somebody with different customs or from a different culture? What happens when, again, they go against the family bloodline because they fell in love with somebody of a different race or nationality? I mean, would they be cut off from the family? Would they be disinherited or shunned? Would the family members feel betrayed and therefore not allow that member to join in any future reindeer games? Well, do blood ties really carry that kind of an emotional weight in families? Well, I tell you what, hold that thought because we're going to come back to this, okay? Let's just dig a little deeper into the physical aspects of blood, okay? Now, most people I know don't really like the sight of blood, okay? Some people can deal with it. Other people are like, okay, no, thank you. And, from its unpleasing odor to its many associations with violence, many people have a phobia of blood. True confession here, folks, I myself am not even fond of having my blood drawn for tests. I can look at it, but it's like, okay, I'm good. Okay, whatever. Okay, pull the needle out. Come on, come on, come on, pull the needle out. And, nonetheless, I know that without blood, we wouldn't exist. Our life wouldn't continue. I mean, blood is that powerful. In fact, people who need transfusions know this all too well, that blood contains everything we need to sustain life. White blood cells fight off infections, red blood cells carry oxygen throughout the body, and platelets clot our blood whenever we bleed. So, in a sense, our blood is kind of a liquid blueprint that really carries our DNA, identifying who we are or who we're related to, and the present status of our health, and yes, even the genealogy of our ancestors. So, yes, blood can tell us many things. However, it's kind of ironic that despite its life-giving qualities, blood does have a shelf life. In fact, the Red Cross donations that are, they're just typically kept no longer than 5 to 6 weeks, because after that time, the red blood cells, the membranes lose their flexibility, and the quality of blood really begins to break down. And furthermore, once blood is spilled, it really leaves what appears to be an everlasting stain on our clothes and skin and really pollutes the environment. And, moreover, blood is probably the most stubborn of all stains to remove. Even after a thorough scrubbing, there are still ways to detect blood stains on all kinds of surfaces, especially how it affects how we perceive ourselves as a soul. Try as we may to scrub and sanitize every inch of contamination, we eventually realize that when it comes to our soul, it takes a lot more than cleanser and bleach to bring us inner tranquility. And in the Bible, do you remember at the trial of Jesus, the Roman governor Pilate, he made this public display in front of everybody. This public display of his innocence by washing his hands of Jesus's blood. And yet he was troubled in his soul by his decision to execute Jesus. And what about Shakespeare's Lady Macbeth, who's, she was just so obsessed scrubbing that, her hands, that she couldn't remove the blood guilt from her soul. And even in Shakespeare's Hamlet, the story begins with the guards anxiously reporting that they saw a ghostly figure. And we later discover in the story that the ghost is the King of Denmark. And Hamlet also witnessed his ghost. who reveals that he's unable to find peace and rest because he was secretly murdered. And as the story unfolds, Hamlet discovers more and more of the truth of his father's death. You know, and when he does this, the more his mother became tormented by her guilt, because, spoiler alert, she was actually in on it. You know, and these and many more examples, the significance of one's violent actions lies not so much in the stubborn removal of the blood-stained crevices of our hands and figures, but rather it lies in the crevices of the human soul for both the victim and the offender. Well, since the beginning of time, you know this as well as I do, humanity has tried to wash its hands of all kinds of atrocities and injustices that have been inflicted on the land and each other. And ironically, such crimes against humanity quite often seem to escalate, especially when they are done for and in the name of God. And in this sense, humanity is just very creative with coming up with all kinds of justifications for shedding another's blood, innocent or otherwise. You know, if you've ever watched the Disney movie Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, you might recognize the phrase, "Well, dead man tell no tales," as uttered by Mr. Cotton's parrot. And many people believe that this was a phrase that was invented by pirates as they swashbuckled their way through perilous voyages in search of buried treasure. And even today, just hearing this phrase might make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. But neither Disney nor the pirates invented this expression. Instead, its origins can be traced back to a proverb by English reformer Thomas Becket. I think it was about like mid-1500s. And he says, "The dead cannot reveal any secrets." Okay. And although this saying has existed for a long time, it really didn't gain popularity until it became famous through the Pirates of the Caribbean ride at Disneyland. You know, so basically to tell no tales means to keep something quiet. Kill anyone who knows about it. And since the person is dead, it would be pretty much impossible for him or her to tell your secret. Well, interestingly, family secrets and personal stories of injustices that were intended to be taken to the grave also live on in present generations. Because you see, blood also carries traumatic energy, as I mentioned, through intergenerational trauma. You know, intergenerational trauma, you know, and the energy through that is not only like passed down through generations, as in the habits and the behaviors and, you know, everything else that was modeled because trauma has never been healed, but it also is carried through the blood. You know, because if the trauma is intense enough, it starts to change the DNA and it gets passed down. And that's why you have, let's say, great-great-grandchildren who are suffering from traumatic energy. You know, they have this intergenerational trauma, but they didn't start with them. It started with grandpa, great-great-grandmother, whoever. Okay. But that's how intergenerational trauma works. Okay. So blood also carries this traumatic energy, as well as this belief that your overall commitment to your family is above everything and everyone else. In fact, those so-called family and societal secrets, they're often revealed again and again through unhealed traumas, as I said, that have been passed down through the language and genetics of blood and the voice of the soul. In fact, for all of our feeble attempts at sanitizing human history, blood spilled in the name of, well, let's just name a few here, blood spilled in the name of murder, genocide, manifest destiny, cover-ups, the doctrine of discovery, slavery, forced starvation and encampments, lynchings, exterminations, and that's just to name a few, folks. All of these are still evident in both the land that holds the traumatic energy, as well as any blood that was spilled has soaked into the ground. It's the traumatic energy behind it. Now, regardless of geography, you know, lands that witness humanity's atrocities against one another have not only absorbed numerous blood-soaked traumas, but also the energy from such traumas have stained the souls of victims and perpetrators who have been unable to free themselves. Okay. And, you know, for me, I really learned this valuable lesson. I've told this story many times that the time I was visiting my Native American teacher and I cut my finger on his wicker chair. And before I could, you know, get a Band-Aid or, you know, a handkerchief or whatever just to cover it up, you know, he grabbed my hand and he goes, "What do you see?" And again, I didn't get the lesson until he said, "Who do you see?" And I thought I was giving him the correct answer by saying, "Oh, okay, I see my parents and my grandparents," you know, knowing that, well, they're in there. And he kept pressing me, really started to irritate me, but he pressed me because he wanted me to get the deeper lesson. And he goes, "Is that all? Is that all you see?" And then it finally clicked. And it's like, no, I see everybody who has come before me. And then this is where the lesson really came home. And he said, "You know, through that single drop of blood, if you are able to see everybody who has come after or has come before you, you're going to be able to see everybody who will come after you." There is this connection, a very strong connection. But he wasn't just talking about blood. He was talking about the soul. But he started off by saying, "Just look at the blood." Okay? So, you know, very fine lesson indeed. And, you know, suddenly, you know, I've heard this Lakota phrase over and over again, but suddenly it made sense. It's Mataki Oasin. We are all related. That phrase really awakened in me a sense that all life is just so intimately connected. And it does cut across all bloodlines, time, and space. I became aware of the interconnectedness of all things on the level of the soul, you know, beyond a simple linear dimension of past, present, future, and blood ties. So for me, this interconnectedness is more like a burst of light extending out into, you know, multidimensional and multi-generational soul relationships. You know, because in that moment, I no longer saw people as being divided by generation or race or gender or nationality or religion or language or culture. I saw all people as beautiful souls in physical bodies. In fact, within like a very split second, everything, the created elements like vegetation, animals, minerals, water, fire, earth, stars, universe, so forth, they really formed this interconnected kaleidoscope in my mind. And the reality of this interconnected and interdependent relationship, which was once just so incomprehensible to me, now resonated with a wave of clarity that also caused me to listen very carefully to the collective cries of the soul, as I had never listened before. So, is blood thicker than water? Or is there a higher, stronger soul connection that we have? Well, there's a lot more to get into in this subject about blood and soul ties, but for now, I really want to hear what's on your heart about this subject. So again, I'm going to take a little break here, and if you'd like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008, and like I said, I'll be taking your call after the break. So again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck, and I'll be back with you in 1 minute. right, welcome back, everybody. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, where we have been discussing the phrase, blood is thicker than water, meaning your family allegiance, that is, your kin, your blood, your sangre, should take precedence over all other relationships, whether they be friendships or work colleagues, schoolmates, or any other connections out there. But, you know, many theologians and scholars and scientists down through the centuries, they've really struggled to espouse the most accurate definition of what the soul is, let alone exactly what is our relationship to the soul. And so, you know, after reading and researching and so forth and contemplating, here's my definition of the soul. The soul is the purest essence of us that exceeds all physical, emotional, and psychological limitations. Because if you strip away everything else in our lives, it is our soul that is a divine mirror of the soul of the universe. Okay? If you didn't get all of that, shoot me an email or, you know, drop me a line and I'll be glad to give you the whole thing. But, you know, it just begs to ask another question here. It's like, is there another relationship that has a stronger connection than the blood that connects you to everyone who has come before you and connects you to everybody who will come after you? Well, there certainly is. The soul is oneness. We come from God, we go back to God. Everything points to this oneness. And even though we're all composed, there we go, of blood and water and muscle and bones and organs and so forth, there's something else that really connects all of us, and that's our soul. Now, granted, throughout history, and even in recent history, we might think that if we spill enough blood and other life-giving resources, we're going to get rid of troublemakers, or our problems will go away, and the issues that have plagued us for a long time will just evaporate. But that kind of thinking is what I like to call lower consciousness, because all those things are based on externals, and the soul is not. Because once we identify and embrace ourselves as souls, we hopefully also realize that there's a more effective way to create change, you know, to transform the negative, destructive energy into a pure energy that heals on a soul level. You see, the soul is not just something we have because of being created, but the soul is who we are authentically. I mean, we're not merely bodies that have souls. We're first and foremost formless divine souls who have the form of bodies. In a sense, it's our mind and our bodies that provide the form. Okay? And the soul is formless. But nonetheless, you know, it's really the cry of the soul in each of us, and this fully realization that we are souls, and that we long to have that connection and reconnection with God, but that's something we already have, because that's something that we already are. Regardless of whether or not we've suffered trauma, really paying attention to ourselves as souls and listening to our inner cry really moves us out of the illusion that a mind and body consciousness rules. Now, as important as they are, the mind and the body are merely vehicles to realize the higher consciousness of the soul. And when we listen attentively to our soul's cry, I mean, really get in there and listen, not with our human ears, but with the intention of listening to the soul, we become aware that everything we truly desire can never be reached by the mind and the body, because these are always driven by ego or selfishness or fear or pain or pleasure or whatever. Now, you know, this is not to say that the mind and the body are all evil and the soul is all good. I mean, that kind of duality thinking drove people in medieval times to punish themselves with physical wounds, you know, believing that they could suppress the ego and physical desires to become more righteous and holy. I mean, they would just whip themselves until they bled. But again, this is a misunderstanding of who we are, souls. We can never attain higher levels of God consciousness through the mind and body because these forms are limited. They're limited. So let's return to the question that I posed earlier. What happens if somebody in the family, anybody in the family, dares to cross that bloodline or break those unwritten family rules that blood represents? So just a quick reminder, what happens when a blood relative wants to marry somebody outside of the family's religion or falls in love with somebody of a different race or nationality? Would they be cut off from the family? Would they be disinherited or shunned? Would the family members feel betrayed and therefore not allow that member to participate in any kind of family activities? I mean, in all honesty, do blood ties really carry that kind of emotional weight in families? Well, all of these scenarios are a possibility, as we know from history. In fact, you may be experiencing some of this treatment in your family today. But still, is there a way back to the family? Or are you forever condemned in their eyes? Well, as long as oneness with your family is based on blood ties, your membership, let's just say, will always be conditional, right? If your acceptance and love in the family goes only so far as your blood connection to rules, then those relationships are based on conditions. And conditional love is really nothing new. It's been going on since the beginning of time. In fact, throughout history, certain diseases have really carried such a social stigma that have often struck fear and contempt in the hearts and lives of people around the world. And it just could be anything that people didn't understand or they feared or whatever. It's like, okay, you're not going to live with us. You're going to live outside the community and see how you like that. Okay. But, you know, many afflicted people interpreted being even like a short-term quarantine. It was really society's way of displaying contempt for people who were sick. You know, and as a result, many felt stigmatized by their illnesses, and they were shunned and alienated from fully participating in their communities as persons of value and worth. Okay. And I believe I shared in a couple of other broadcasts that Irving Goffman, he wrote that the Greeks actually coined the term stigma to refer to bodily signs that expose something unusual and negative about the person, you know, their moral status. And so these signs to drive home a point of society's contempt were imposed by society, and they were cut or burned into a person's body, which clearly advertised his or her condition, you know, whether they were a slave, a criminal, a traitor. You know, what was that famous story from Hawthorne, The Scarlet Letter, right? And so this act of branding signified to all that the recipient was a blemished person, ritually and polluted, and they were to be avoided, especially in public places. So such markings not only spoiled a person's social identity, but it also cut off that person from society and really forced him or her to live out in isolation in a very unaccepting world. And, you know, just from this aspect alone, it appeared as though there was just no way to remove this outward sign, let alone recover from the emotional wounding from such harsh treatment. And yet, this wasn't always the case. Okay? So, you know, let's just say, according to the ancient Israelite purity laws, there's this distinction made between people who are clean and unclean, or they are holy, or they're unholy. And cleanliness was really considered the normal condition of most things and people. And so anything else like death, sickness, disease, coming in contact with blood, so forth, was considered a deviation from this cleanliness or from the norm. And so therefore, this carrier was separated from the community for a period of time to avoid further contamination. Okay. And although this purity system was meant to impose a temporary isolation, the practice eventually became an acceptable way to expel people permanently who polluted society by their conditions, let's just say. Now, this expulsion was not only true for people who had an identifiable condition, but what about people who had a condition that was not so readily seen? Maybe mental illness. You know, because in today's society, not all the signs of socially intolerable diseases are immediately visible. And yet, once such a condition was disclosed, society's overall contempt for what is deemed unacceptable behavior or flawed character really reduces that person from a whole and unique individual to a tainted, discredited one. So when a society imposes its stigma on a person, this ultimately leads to disenfranchisement, you know, placing a person in a context in which he or she is just not accorded the social right, let's just say, to have his or her voice heard or even their vote counted. And such people believe that they were just relegated to second-class status and subjected to political suppression. Now, really, in severe cases, as I mentioned, you know, trauma can be passed down genetically, and it can attach itself to our DNA and often covertly disguise itself as harmful physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual symptoms. And so, as I mentioned earlier, you know, this is intergenerational trauma. It's passed down through societies and families. That is what we carry in our genes or how we were raised, you know, and various social systems also galvanized harmful stereotypes. Okay, so therefore, I mean, intergenerational trauma is not just limited to how it affects our families, but it also affects all relationships, from the most intimate to the mere acquaintances in our lives. You know, but this realization is also a significant aspect for healing our relationships. You know, if we take a step back and if we're able to understand or consider what has so wounded another person, what has so wounded ourselves, you know, so that we continuously act out of our woundedness, and yet we want to expect different results. And, you know, all I have to say is that from personal experience, okay, folks, and this is just me talking, that understanding the background of those who have hurt me has allowed me to take the necessary steps closer to forgiving and releasing the burdens of carrying around my wounds any longer. Okay? You know, I wanted to be unburdened by my bitterness, unforgiveness, shame, and humiliation, or any other pain I was carrying around, so I needed to ask for forgiveness, as well as this happens when people ask forgiveness from ourselves. When we grant them forgiveness for saying, yes, put that burden down. Yes, I accept your apology, or in other ways. Okay. So, and I say all that, you know, is just to really bring us back around here. We often see ourselves as being separate from everyone else and all things. You know, could this be we may have accidentally bumped into another person? And we may believe, well, I got nothing in common with them because they're not a blood relative. And this was true if all we did was focus on externals. We could say, yeah, more than likely, you know, 9 times out of 10, yeah, we don't have anything in common with them if we're focused on the externals. But what if we allowed ourselves to see one another as souls? You know, just what if? I mean, certainly we would then understand the oneness or connection we share with others, regardless of race, class, creed, culture, stereotypes, prejudices, stigmas, or language, or family blood ties. And this is all the more reason why it's so important to see the divine in everybody. Because when we're ready, God really opens up for us a profound understanding of who we are as souls. Because when we look at each other as souls, as we understand each other as souls, we soon discover, well, we see ourselves more clearly as souls. And we begin to realize that externals don't matter, that there really is no more sexism, that there's no more racism, there's no more ageism. In fact, there's no more isms at all, because they just simply can't hold up to the standard that we are all souls, that we are all children of light, or we're all droplets of water returning to the ocean. Okay, pick your metaphor. I mean, we're no different from one another, albeit externally. So whether or not you believe in reincarnation or destiny or fate, you know, just really focus on the people in your life who you may see day in and day out, especially the people whom you don't see. You know, the ones who work behind the scenes, the invisible people, as it were. We pass them by every day, but we really don't want to take notice, or we just don't take notice. Do we have a connection with them? Do we ever consider ourselves one with them? Absolutely. I mean, how many of us perceive ourselves as lacking something we already possess? How many of us put so much faith in a blood tie that we give in to those unwritten rules of do not cross the family, for you are blood, and blood is thicker than water. And after all, don't go and getting too big for your britches, because we know where you come from, and we don't want you to ever forget where you came from. So any talk of like, but I don't see that person as evil. I don't see that person as different. Yeah, they may not be part of the bloodline, but I see something stronger than a bloodline. I see their soul, and they see me as a soul. You are all loved out there by the soul of the universe. God, who loves you with an unconditional and everlasting love. And once we recognize this soul presence in one another, once we embrace it, once we live it, we're not going to settle for any other kind of conditions placed on another person's acceptance of us based on what they want us to be for them. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Thank you for spending this hour with me. So, you know, if you do have any other questions or concerns, or just want to drop a line and chit chat, you know, do so in one of those two websites, and I will read them and gladly just reach out to you and just say thank you. And you know, you can engage in a little bit more discussion about this subject tonight. So in 2 weeks, we'll talk again. But in the meantime, everybody behave themselves, everybody be safe, and everybody find yourself as that soul and be that soulful presence in this world. Good night.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.